Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel speeding in!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
I think I'm ready. Rusty, I feel ready.
All right, baby.
Yeah, hi, everyone. It's Jungle Jim Jerome coming at you with another episode of The Suspendables with the one and only longtime NHLer, Russ Cortinel. Rusty, how are you doing today?
Huh? I'm doing good, bud.
Yeah, you're all right?
Yeah.
I always get nervous saying I'm ready, knowing that you're the one coming on. On the show today, no guests today. It's me and Rusty. We're going to talk about a couple of things. One of them is the new division, the Northern Division, all the Canadian teams in the NHL. The league, I think, with what happened with the pandemic, I think, thought, this will create a bunch of rivalries. This is what the fans want, and I'm not sure that's working or not. I'm going to ask Russ about that. Someone wants to know how I got the name Jungle. Okay, that's a huge topic.
Yeah, oh my God.
Also from another fan, who would be your dream foursome? They want to know. These are people who want to know things about you, Russ. And also, someone else said, what was Russ like as a kid? Because he's really tough on you, Jungle. they want to know what you were like as a kid. God. And I thought maybe we'd go through your, as something fun, we would go through your Wikipedia page. Go down there and of course, it talks about all your highlights. That would be great.
Had a lot of energy as a kid.
You did. You did. Well, let's start there. Okay, we know what you're like as a player. We know what you're like as an adult, and I think you're a kid as an adult.
Yeah. Paris would agree that I haven't grown up yet.
Yeah, I was not comfortable being a kid. It was not my element when I started. Getting into grade 3 and 4 and stuff like that.
Especially in you'd hit puberty. You were 15. All the other kids were 8 and 9. No wonder you felt uncomfortable.
Yeah, worst 5 years of high school. For worst 5 years was grade 8.
You drove the yellow bus and followed the kids to class.
That's what people are right away, huh? In the first few minutes.
How long did you convince him you were the security guard?
Shut up. things were tough on me in school, man.
So you were trading lunches with them?
Oh, my God. Okay, here we go. Keep going. All right, keep going. Snap a White Claw, would you? Okay,
oh, I just did.
I know you did. Okay. So what were you like? You grew up in Oak Bay.
Yeah.
Where is Oak Bay part of Victoria? Where is Oak Bay?
Oak Bay is a municipality of Victoria. My dad and my aunt and my great grandfather moved there from Winnipeg when my dad was 16, and they moved out to Victoria. And then my dad was working for BC Forest Products. We moved up to Yubo, and we were all born. Everyone in my family is born in Duncan, except my sister was born in Yubo, where my dad worked at the logging mill there. That's now not there anymore. But anyways, we moved to Victoria when I was 4 or 5, and lived right near Willow School, and we all went to Willow School from kindergarten through 7th grade. It was just a great neighborhood, and we had free reign. Put it this way, whenever something happened in our neighborhood of Oak Bay, the cops came to our door first. Like if it was an egging or, somebody got a water balloon, maybe when they're driving by and it went through, they were smoking a cigarette and they had their window down. And instead of hitting the window, it hit them in the head. When the neighbor's garden, on a Friday, it was full. And Saturday morning, there was one vegetable left in the garden.
That's funny.
Apple trees went, oh my God, it was a fun place. I mean, it was harmless fun. We weren't robbing stores or doing anything crazy, but anything that went on in our sleepy neighborhood,
right.
The old knock, knock, knock. Archie, where were the boys at 7 o'clock this evening?
Oh, that's funny, man. Anyway, what was school like for you, Rusty? Were you smart?
No, I struggled with comprehension. I probably because of
kidding.
ADHD. Yeah, no kidding, right? I was really good in math, but reading comprehension, retaining information was really hard on me, and so I struggled. But I worked hard enough that some of the classes I worked harder than others, but when I was a little older and the college scholarship started coming around, I was like, geez, am I really worthy of college or should I go play major junior hockey?
Right.
And lucky for me, I went to played for the Victoria Cougars and I went the major junior route, but I wasn't an A student by any means or a B student. I was more in the C+ range and good in math though. I was always,
were you scrappy in the schoolyard?
No, I wasn't. I was pretty small as a kid. So a lot of chatter and a lot of running. That guy was fast. Guys my size and stuff. But when I was 14 at Notre Dame, I was the smallest or second smallest kid in the entire school. So I couldn't back up anything I was chirping about. So I was very, very aware of who the tough guys were in the school. My brother Jeff, on the other hand, wasn't a big guy, but he was really, as we know, as a player, he was tough and he could scrap. And my younger brother, it kind of skipped Russ. So I got an older brother who was tough and a younger brother who was tough. So I was in good hands with those guys whenever trouble hit.
When you went to Notre Dame, you're 14 when you went, so
yeah,
like starting grade 9. Is that the deal?
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you apprehensive? I don't blame your parents for going, send them to Notre Dame.
Yeah. It's actually a cool story. Before you make fun of it, my dad loved the concept and Notre Dame in Saskatchewan, Wilcox. There was a couple kids from Victoria, much older than me, that went, and he was amazed how it turned them around. They're really good hockey players, but they came back totally different. And so my dad started looking into it. Notre Dame would sometimes travel across the country and play exhibition games. They were an excellent hockey program, teams. And so when my dad became ill with, he became incredibly depressed and for about a year and eventually took his life. During that year, he'd always tell me, you're going to go to Notre Dame. You're going to go to Notre Dame. I promise you. I promise you. Mm-hmm. And then one day my dad passed away in August when I was 13.
Wow.
And then during that sort of few months or maybe a little bit, maybe a year after, we got a call from Notre Dame out of the blue. We're all sitting around having dinner. It's my mom and my brothers, my sister. And she's talking to somebody on the phone. We don't know who. And she just kept saying, he's too young. He's too young. He's too young. And she hangs up and I go, who was that? She said, that was someone from Notre Dame. And they want you to come there. And I'm nice. Like, oh my God, I didn't say it out loud, but that's what my dad promised me.
Right.
And, I thought I wanted to go. So the president, Martin Kenny of Notre Dame. And he called back a few days later at lunch hour because he knew my mom would be at work and I would be at home. And so he talked to me and he said, look, you should come. You're not too young. We'll take care of everything. And right. we didn't have a lot of money. So I phoned my mom. She was at work. She had to go to work after my dad had died. So she started working after being a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm.
What did she do, Russ?
She worked at a, she was a secretary at a law firm, and typing all the, you know, back then they typed everything. So she was a really good typer. So she, that's what she did before kids, was she worked as a typist or whatever. So she answered the phone and
whatever they were.
Yeah. And, she did that. And then, I phoned her at work and I said, I'm going to Notre Dame. And she said, what? And then I said, yeah, because we can't afford that. And I said, they just said, send along a check for whatever you can afford. So my mom wrote a check.
Wow. Like for the good old days, huh?
Yeah. $1,000 I think she sent me there with. And I think the school, somebody paid for the rest. I think it was 4,000 total. And I was 14 and I was in the middle of the country, out in the prairies for the first time in my life. And I was the first week was great. And then I got to call home every Sunday night and I called home and I was bawling my eyes out. Yeah. My mom was beside herself. She was having a big Sunday supper and she couldn't sleep for a week. And then I wasn't allowed to call. And then it got better and it got better and it got better. And so the second Sunday, so 2 weeks after I arrived, I phoned home like nothing. Mom, I met this person and that person. I got great roommates and, oh, you should see this. And that was it. And I was, the homesick had gone away and I loved it. I just loved being there and being around, all the other kids. And that's kind of I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but anyways, that's my Notre Dame story. And, 14 years old, leaving home. It was my choice, but somebody else, I don't know how, to this day, nobody knows how they called me. Like I asked Martin Kenny when he was alive, how did you know? And he goes, I don't know. I don't know how the connection was, but there was a connection. And he goes, I can't remember. And so to this day, I don't know if my dad called before he passed away or someone obviously contacted them. How would they know about a kid in Victoria, in Oak Bay, playing at Victoria Racquet Club, minor hockey? But they called and I went. So then I missed a year when I was 15. Then I went back when I was 16. So I went there for 2 total years.
Right. I mean, that was back in the day. Are you 54, Russ? I forget.
55. I'll be 56 in June.
June what?
2nd.
June 2nd.
Yeah.
That's my brother's birthday.
I know.
Yeah.
And it's Gretz's brother-in-law, Janet's brother's birthday, too.
Oh, there we go. All the idiots were born on June 2nd.
Three Stooges.
I'm going to get in trouble. God.
Is that the same brother that suckered you?
That's the same. No, that's the brother I lost.
Because I was going to ask for his number to come by and visit you again.
No, he's on the 3rd, actually. He's the next day. But my 2 brothers were June 2nd and 3rd. Rusty, that's interesting because that's back in. So you're talking 40 years ago, you know, over 40 years ago. And you went to effectively what they call now hockey academies, which is commonplace today. You know, there's a couple of them here in Edmonton, for example, where kids do just what you did. They show a bunch of promise. They're good. And they go to these schools, of course, and where it focuses on whatever sport, you know, but boy, there couldn't have been, that many around. You know,
Notre Dame was very unique back then. It in the West, in the East, I think, you know, you had St. Mike's and you had Upper Canada College and a couple in Ontario. But as far as the West, Western Canada, I don't know if there was another one like it. And everybody was in awe and they called it the cult. There's all these nicknames, you know, for it, but they developed some great, great hockey players. I mean, I was fortunate enough when I was there, when I was 14, I got to watch the midget team that won at that time, the Canadian Championships was called the Wrigleys, and then it became the Canada Cup. And then I don't know what it's called now.
But Max, mate, was the Max team, or that's younger, maybe?
No, Max is a Christmas tournament in Calgary. I played in that, but maybe it's called Max. I don't know, but there was a Max tournament in Calgary that was very popular also for midget hockey.
Right.
But I got to see, I got to watch this team that out of the 20 players on the midget team, 12 of them got drafted into the NHL.
I was just going to ask you. We know the two other most popular guys beside you was Gary Lehman and, of course, Wendell Clark.
Yeah, yeah, the Hound Line in Toronto.
The Hound Line. Who else, Russ? What are some other names of guys that we would know who were there when you were there?
Well, Gord Kluzak, unfortunately, he was the first pick overall, played for Billings in the Western Hockey League, and then he blew his knee out once or twice, and it just it shortened his career, and we never saw the true Gord Kluzak, one of the best minor hockey players I've ever seen, you know, like as a 15-year-old. He was phenomenal. And so he was first pick overall. James Patrick was on that team. Rod Brindamore, Curtis Joseph were on a team that won a national title together. Vince LeCavier went there. There is such a huge list of names that when I was involved with Notre Dame trying to raise money, I went to New York to meet with Bettman and the president of our school trying to raise money. And we sat down with him. And he couldn't believe how many people, had, girls and boys, have gone through Notre Dame and end up having a huge impact on hockey. And he tried to help us out, but it just never came about. But anyways, he was shocked at the list of names that have gone through there and made it, either drafted and made it or just drafted into the NHL. It's an incredible list.
So how does it work, Russ, the whole program? You know, how do they split classroom time? How are you practicing every day? Is it, you know, a bunch of games and all that stuff? How do they put kids through high school at the same time with a focus on hockey?
I don't know what it's like today, but when I went, we practiced after school. Just we went to school, regular hours, same lunch break as every other school that I went to before and after. And then after you had like a 30-minute, 45-minute homework room that you attended after school was over. So you get your homework done and then the sports would start. And it was, you know, the Bantams would go out first before dinner. We always practice before dinner. The midget teams would practice after and it was staggered. So the older you were, the later the ice was. But
gotcha, yeah.
I don't know if they practice during, maybe they do during phys ed now. They might get away with that it can be used as hockey. I'm sure it is because they've had a great girls program there now. And so they've grown as a hockey program, but I'm sure they practice during school for a phys ed.
Any things you didn't like about it, Russ? Like, I don't want to say bad memories, but
food sucked when I went there. Yeah, you learned how to make Kraft dinner and grilled cheese sandwiches and anything, ramen noodles, anything you could fit in a crock pot or a little frying pan in your room. But care packages, like I write letters home to all my aunts and uncles and just they would write back anything you need. And I go, yeah, care package.
Steak.
steak. So I learned to appreciate food there because the food was not great, but it is much, much better now. You know, we're talking 40 years ago.
Right, right.
They had in the middle, I'll tell you how bad it was. I remember the head, you can't call him a chef. He was a cook. They had two garbage cans in the front of the room, and one was orange Tang and the other was powdered milk.
Gee,
and so you go there and you scoop out your drink, your whatever you're drinking. That. Oh God, it was so bad though.
Right.
And then once, if somebody got pink eye, everybody got pink eye. If somebody got the flu, everybody got the flu. I mean, talk about pandemics. I mean, God, every 3 weeks you had something going on.
Right. Right. With that experience, Russ is, had you made a decision, you and Paris as parents then, that your own kids who are highly accomplished athletes, where did Lawton go to high school then, who's shown a bunch of promise here as a hockey player?
So he left home at 14 also, and guess what? He went to Notre Dame. So he went for 1 year, played Bantam, and then he went to Omaha. He played so he 14 there, 15 back here, and then 16 he went to Omaha and he played for Dave Wilkie, who was a first round pick of the Montreal Canadiens, and he and I had a training camp together when I was still in Montreal.
Right.
And we crossed paths coaching. Our kids are the same age. So we crossed paths at tournaments and hung out, might have had a few beers after the games when the kids were asleep.
Yep.
And he was such a great coach. Yeah. I love the way he coached. I love the way his teams play. So he was in Omaha. And I sent Lawton to Omaha to play for him for a year. And then Lawton got drafted into the USHL and he started playing. And he played a couple different teams and then he went to college. So he's been gone since he's been 14 years old. Lawton's only been home 1 year.
Wow.
He left home, yeah.
Well, he's a great young kid.
Thanks.
Just a reminder, if you'd like to connect online with Russ or Jimmy or engage with them on social media, find out how at thesuspendables.com.
So let's go through your, I'll go to some of the stuff we talked about before, but I said, let's go through Russ's Wikipedia page and get his thoughts on some of this stuff. The first thing that sticks out, Rusty, is he was considered a top prospect pretty early on in your career. I guess, were you playing for the Cougars, Victoria Cougars?
Yeah, I ended up, and that's where I got drafted to Toronto the first round. Yeah.
So how did you find out that, Russ? How did when someone probably pulled you aside and had the foresight to look at you as a talent and say, kid, you got what it takes here, and I believe you're going to go to the NHL. Or tell me how that all came down the very first time that someone with authority must have said to you, here's what I see for you in the future.
Well, I had belief in myself that I was a good player, and I'd had success at Notre Dame the year before when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And teams started writing me letters, college teams. So I had college teams writing me letters. My rights were owned by Medicine Hat Tigers. And my coach, Barry McKenzie at Notre Dame, wanted me to come back so that he wanted me to go to college. So he wanted me to finish my high school at Notre Dame and then go off to university. And he sat down with all our entire team that year at the end of the year. And he tried to convince all of us who were, finishing our midget year to come back.
Right.
And he's like, there's no guarantee if you play junior hockey, if you go to college, you're going to at least get a degree if you don't make it. So he felt like that was the better route for all of us. And that's his advice. And so,
although every kid hates to hear that.
College. Yeah. But Barry said, there's only two of you in this room that I think will make it. And I'm not being arrogant, but I mean, this will probably sound arrogant, but I was like looking around the room going, I wonder who the other guy is.
Attaboy. Attaboy.
I knew where I stood on my team. So I was like, hey, I'm one of the top players. So I wanted it, but I don't know if I believed it entirely. So I'll tell you when I realized that I had a chance and that I thought I was going to make it, I make the Victoria Cougars. Mm-hmm. I get off to a good start. I'm playing well. I'm playing with my brother and Stu Kulak. We got a really good line and we're playing good and the team's good. We got a really good team. And I'm on the bus. I don't know which city we were going to. And somebody passed me the hockey news. And I started reading through the hockey news and it had Central Scouting. And there was only 21 NHL teams at that time. And I was rated 18th to go in the first round. And that was the first time I went, holy shit, I have a chance. Oh my. And then the next month I was rated 15th. So I started moving up and I went, oh my God, the better I play, the higher I'm going to go. I'm not stuck. And then I think I was the highest I was rated was 10th or 11th. And I ended up getting picked in the seventh overall. And so that year playing junior was when it really came together. I mean, I hit puberty late. I was small. There was all these factors. I was thinking why I wouldn't make it, you know, what would stop me from making it? And then when things started clicking and I started growing and I started putting on, and I was competing at the highest level in junior hockey, and I was doing well. And then in the playoffs, I had a great playoff, and Mark Morrison was first in scoring. I was second on our team, and then I got drafted by the Leafs, and then you go to camp, and now it starts all over again. You right. go, oh God, you know, now you're with men. I mean, I'm freaking 18 years old, and they told me right off the bat I wasn't going to make it. So the pressure really wasn't on that year, because I knew they were sending me back to junior.
Right.
And then started playing junior hockey again, had that camp experience. Then I went to World Juniors. Then I got picked by the Olympic team, and then I turned pro. And then it starts, you know, you have success, you don't have success. I didn't start my career the way I wanted to. And I don't want to get into all that, but I started making steps again, moving up, but it wasn't instant. It didn't happen as soon as I got there. It took some time. And there was a few times I thought I was going to get sent to the minors, and then you get traded, wasn't playing, in and out of the lineup. I mean, there was a lot of insecurities in the first few years of my career. And then once you get that, once you're established, like for me, once you get, you score 20 goals a couple times, and you know, you start looking around going, okay, this is where I fit on this team. And mm-hmm. so then you establish yourself, and then, you know, 16 years total, I stayed, and I loved it, and I enjoyed it, and wasn't always rosy, but you know, it was a great career, and I'm so blessed that I got paid to do something I love to do, and got to play in the NHL, which every kid who plays hockey wants to accomplish. So mm-hmm. I was so fortunate to have that opportunity, and I loved it.
Did you ever get cut, Russ, from any teams along the way? Like from as far back as you can remember. When are you? So you're born in what? 65? 1965?
Yeah. No, I never did.
Never got. Oh, you cut. Lucky prick! Do you know how many teams I got cut from?
Yeah, the 91 Canada Cup team. I was lucky to make that team, and I told this story where Claude Lemieux and I are roommates. Final cuts, and he got cut, and I got to stay. And
but did you answered the phone, right?
And no, Claude answered the phone. Oh no, Claude answered the phone, and he's going, yeah, and it's Mike Keenan, and he's going, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll tell him. Okay, yeah, no problem. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm done.
All right.
What is he going to tell me? I'm going home. So Claude gets up and he goes, well, you're staying and I'm leaving. Have a great time. And I think we both had our bags packed. I think we both were ready to go, because either way, I think one of us, whoever stayed, we had to move into a different room. So we're sitting there with our bags packed, and jeez. Boom. Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty. And there was six of us. There was Stevie Eisenman got cut.
Shit. Wow.
Yeah. Joe Sakic got cut.
Holy man.
Yeah.
How good was that team?
Yeah. No kidding. It was a good team. I played with Lindros and, I think Shane Corson and I, Shane and Mike Shan, or Brendan Shanahan was, I played with Shanny and Lindros. And
wow. Lindros must have been young.
He was 18. They kept him. It was a big controversy. They kept him over Eisenman.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
It didn't go over well.
My favorite Claude Lemieux story is he was playing in the member guest with a buddy of yours. I won't mention his name. And they hooked up a boat trailer to the back of their golf cart.
Wasn't it a
Sea-Doo, like, or
two Sea-Doos or something?
Yeah. Like, and they everyone was hammered. It was a great tournament.
And it was for the hole in one prize on a par three.
Yeah,
and they had it on display, right?
Yeah. And they hooked it up to the back of their cart.
Yeah.
And then ended up sort of riding it down the hill on the famous,
which is a very steep hill.
Yeah. And then everyone's standing in the clubhouse going, this cannot be real. And anyway, the thing is, you know, this is 1,000 pounds or 2,000 pounds coming down on you. I just remember their eyeballs going like saucers, looking at the bridge that was coming up. And of course, the thing, the thing jackknifed and they totaled the Sea-Doo. It's like, this is an unbelievable movie. Anyway, great guy. I like Clovermule. I don't know where he is now, what he's doing, is if he's around or if he's involved in hockey at all.
He's representing players. He works for an agency.
Oh, okay. Good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good for him. So the rest of the highlights, Russ, on our Wikipedia. Then in 1984, you get the call to go play for the Olympic team.
Yeah, that was something.
Walk us through that.
So we're in Ottawa practicing before we went.
You're with the Leafs in 84?
Well, I'd been drafted. I got drafted the summer before. Then I went back to junior. I get picked to go play for Canada. And Killers got us in Ottawa and we're practicing there before we go to Sweden for the Ryan World Juniors. Yep. And the assistant coach of the Olympic team, Dave King was the head coach, and George Kingston and Jean Perron were the assistant coaches. And George Kingston came up to me and he said, we really like the way you're playing. If you go over and you play as well as you're playing right now or in the World Junior tournament, would you like to come play for the Olympic team? And I'm like, are you kidding me?
What the
F? It's a trick question. So I went over there and had that in the back of my mind. I didn't tell anybody that I had spoke to him, and he probably told me not to say anything, but I did not tell anyone on the team what happened with George.
Wow. And so that must have been hard not to tell anyone.
Yeah. And then I went over and unfortunately we didn't win. We came fourth and I played well again. And in fact, it's kind of a lot of humble brags here, but.
No, they're not humble.
Yeah. Mike Shanahan's going to be laughing right now, listening to this podcast. Cause he's always like humble brag.
Right.
Tell him. And anyways, I got back after the tournament, and the first phone call I received when I landed was from the Olympic team. And they said, go home, get your stuff in Victoria and see you in Calgary.
So on the plane, Russ, you must have told strangers, like tap the guy going, hey, you need to know something. I'm on the Olympic team. You know, that must have been just crazy.
No, I didn't. I really didn't. I went home and told my mom. And
she cried.
Oh my God, she was so excited. And my stepdad, they just got married. So my mom's remarried. So I tell them that they're going, we're coming, we're going to the Olympics. Yeah, they're panicking, trying to get flights and all that stuff.
Where were the Olympics that year?
Sarajevo,
right?
So then I get home, I change I wash my clothes from the World Juniors and then get on a plane to Calgary. I walk in the room and it was like the plague showed up because guys have been together forever. And now this new guy comes in at the very last minute they cut a guy for me to fit, you know, into the lineup.
Oh, you must have been hated.
Fuck. It was terrible. And so Dave Gagne was there and he and I just played in the World Championships together. He was already on the team.
Yep.
And so he came over, played in the World Championships, and then went back. And then James Patrick, who I went to Notre Dame with a couple years before that, he was on the team. So I at least had two people that were kind of being nice to me, but the rest of the team was
glommed onto them.
It was brutal. Like I'm sitting in his stall and like the guy they liked, they cut him. And then after a while, they, you know, loosen up. Patrick Flatley was great. And he was really nice to me.
Wonderful guy. I remember
meeting him a
couple years ago. Yeah.
And anyway, so and Kirk Muller was on the team. And then Mark Morrison was on the team. He couldn't play because he had played 9 games the year before for the New York Rangers. And they considered him a pro. So he wasn't allowed to play
in the tournament. Right. Tell me this, Rusty. You hear it from time to time with guys who play international tournaments, whether representing their company, country, either in the Olympics or whatever world events. You'll hear guys say, kind of the weight of the country they felt like it was on their shoulders. How did you feel about that when you were representing Canada? Did it come into the fold at all?
Well, remember I told you that my dad used to have a stand for the anthem on Saturday nights in front of the TV for Hockey Night in Canada.
Yes, right, right.
So we're very proud Canadian. So for me, it was like, it was unbelievable. And so I was so excited to wear the uniform for both the junior team and the Olympic team. And to hear the anthem after you win is so freaking cool. They play the anthem after you win.
Right.
And then back then people sent telegrams and wishing us luck. And they were like, "Hey, Joe and Mary from Saskatoon, we just wishing you all the best of luck."
Wow.
And da, da, da. And they taped them to the wall of our locker room. By the time the Olympics, we were in the medal round, the entire walls of our changing room and our locker room and bathrooms were completely plastered with these little notes.
Is that ever cool?
Yeah. And Dave King probably, you know, had the trainer put those up and let these guys see how many people back home want them to win. And, you know, God, we...
They're making you nervous?
Oh, not nervous. No, I wasn't excited more than anything. I just get so pumped up. And I guess playing the Russians, I was nervous because they were,
they might kill you.
Well, I was 18 and they all looked like they were 30. They were 25 to 30, yeah, maybe. And they just at 18, they just looked so much older than us. But
nervous you were going to get hurt or just
no, just nervous that they were the best team, not in the NHL, mm-hmm, you know, in the world. They were it. The Red Army. And so, it was, you know, I'd watch them play Trechak and Fedosov and Makarov, Krutov, Larionov. Wow. I mean, every off was right there. And we're playing against them. And there's just, it was like the first time you went out and skated against Wayne Gretzky. That's
gotcha.
How it felt.
Yeah. Right.
That's how it felt.
Cool, man. We're going through your Wikipedia page here still. So, the other highlight I whipped down here, this is great, by the way. 1989, you end up going to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Uh-huh.
That's got to go down in the history books for Rusty Cortinel as one of the biggest days of your life when you won the semis.
Yeah, I mean, to go to the to have a chance when you're in the finals. I only made it there once and we didn't win. It just sucked. It's bittersweet. You know, you get there, you're excited, and then when you lose, it just blows.
Someone asked, I've been watching the Australian Open. I love it. I love the big majors in the tennis. And John McEnroe, who you know, who plays at your golf club, great guy. He was playing with the G-man one day and my son knew who he was. I was showing him the vid, saying, "Look at there's John McEnroe." And
yeah.
And in 5 minutes later, he sent a video to my son saying, "Hey Jake, how's it going? Thanks for being a fan." Right. My son was like, "Is that for real, Dad?" I said, "Yeah." Anyway, he was talking yesterday when you talk about, because it's interesting when we do ask you about going to the Stanley Cup final. For me, as a fan, you know, it's like, way to go. Congratulations, man. You made it to the Stanley Cup final. But you've always been a little harsher on yourself about it, going, I don't want to talk about it. We lost.
Yeah.
You know, which really shows this unbelievable competitive side to you. Last night, during the game, during one of the matches, the tennis matches, McEnroe was commentating, and I think it's an Australian guy, Cahill, who had asked him about, you know, the biggest match. Right. And you're mm-hmm. thinking it's going to be this thing. And the guy says, "The biggest match you ever lost." And McEnroe's, there's like a big pause. He's going to murder this guy, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes, there's still this pregnant pause. And it's more of a pause, more of a pause, more of a pause. And McEnroe goes, "Can someone get my psychiatrist on the line, please?"
That's so good.
What are you doing to me, dude? You know? Yeah. I was laughing because I often ask you about that. And then the other two, Russ, you played in the two of the biggest cities in the world. When you went to New York, Russ, is that different than playing in Mini or Dallas or Montreal or Toronto when you went to the Big Apple?
It is. And here's, so Toronto, Montreal, you can't go anywhere without somebody recognizing you. And then you go to New York and you can walk around the city and nobody recognizes you. But when you get on the ice, it's just like the other cities. Right. So it's interesting. You have this freedom there that you don't have in Toronto and Montreal. Mm-hmm. Gretz and I would walk around the streets and I'm waiting for somebody to, you know, stop him. And it was unbelievable how many people didn't know it was him, just because they don't follow hockey, probably, right? If you follow hockey, you know him. But God, you get inside that building, the Madison Square Garden, and it's exactly like Montreal. It's exactly like Toronto, the passion, right. The fans are going crazy. It's a blast. So it was interesting to be there and have that freedom outside to just be yourself and not, you know, be looking over your shoulder.
Right. You know, a lot of people will understand this when I say this, but you know, Wayne, of course, had no choice when he went to LA from Edmonton. As he says, I got sold. I didn't get traded.
Right.
But in hindsight, when he looks back, of course he ended up loving Los Angeles and he's mm-hmm. spent almost his whole life there, of course, since he got traded there. But what did come out of it that he said was, I can walk around without being, he never calls it harassed. He never says, I get harassed, I get hounded. He never says that. He realized that's part of the deal.
Yeah.
However, he said, it has given me some relief.
Yeah.
Of being able to, like, he would never, in Edmonton, he wouldn't get in his car and go to a Starbucks because it would take him an hour to get out, you know?
Well, when we were at the
Olympics.
But
he can there, sorry. But he can in LA, right? He says, I go down. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, when we were at the Olympics together in Vancouver and we went, he's like, meet me here. So we go there, go to this hotel, and on the second floor was this bar and we're having a drink and we walk somewhere up Robson Street and he put his head down and he just is walking like as fast as I've ever seen him walk. And then as he gets by people are like, oh my God, that's Wayne Gretzky. And you just hear behind us, that's Gretzky. That's the great one. That's all right, Gretzky. Like all of a sudden it just builds and builds and builds. And then when we went to Halifax that one time and for the golf tournament, and there was 10,000 people outside the restaurant chanting his name. And he so loves Canada, but the living in LA does give him that freedom. And, I got to tell now that we're on Gretz. So I've talked about Ron LaForge and my buddy who was fighting cancer, and we gave him a shout out.
Right.
And he just recently passed away after a long, long battle. Oh. And so they're showing videos and stuff, and the great one,
You're okay. You're okay, man. I get it.
He got Kid Rock to sing him a song.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it was just
wow.
It was amazing. And, you know, Gretz is always thinking about other people. And anyways, he did that for Ronnie. It was just unbelievable.
Right.
And there's Kid Rock, like, it's live. He's, you know, it's so cool with technology. And so Gretz has got, they're FaceTiming, I guess. So then he sang the song to Ronnie. Anyways, poof.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was going to get that emotional telling that story, it's a beautiful thing, and we lost a good guy.
Right. Well, it never it's never easy, Rusty, but the you know, it's a story about Wayne and Kid Rock for that matter.
Yeah, and Kid's just such a great guy. I don't know if you noticed there's this El Presidente from Barstool. He's raising money for restaurants, and so people are donating money, and then he phones restaurants, or they apply for assistance, financial assistance, till they get back on their feet. And I've been following this guy, and it's just awesome the reactions that these restaurant owners are giving him, and he's
Kid Rock, but, Russ.
No, sorry, but Kid Rock gave $100,000 to this fund.
Jesus,
yeah, Kid's amazing. A great guy. He came to our charity event. You met him there.
I played golf with him.
Yeah, I know. And he was the first guy in our, we only auctioned off 20 or 10 items, live items. He bought the first one for like $24,000 and he never went on the trip. And he wired the money like on Monday. Our lady, Judy Christensen, who's running our event, she gets a call from Kid Rock's manager on Monday. And he's like, I'm told to send $24,000 to the Cornell Celebrity Classic. How do I do it? Where do I send it? I mean, he was the first guy to pay.
Cool.
So he's just he's a wonderful human being, and to do that, and you know, I'm sure these guys like Wayne, they get a million people asking them to do stuff, but Wayne and him are very, very good friends from that tournament. That's where they first, they first met there.
And he's not the, I don't know how to say this, but he's not the guy of the lyrics in his song. You know, his songs are pretty raw, right?
Yeah.
Kid Rock, man, comes from way outside, man, when he does this, he's the American badass. And, but he's not that guy at all. You know, that's an act, folks. Okay.
Well, I'll tell the story at the Cornell Celebrity Classic in 2003 when we had our first one there. At Victoria Golf Club, and Jimmy, you did a great job emceeing. And on the third tee box, we allowed the media to come onto the, and they could interview all the celebrities. So Gretz and Kid are playing, and there, and we warned them. We warned every celebrity, okay, when you get to third tee box, the media is going to be there, but they won't be anywhere else on the golf course. So the media goes, Wayne, can we get an interview? And he goes, yeah, just hang on a sec. And he put his cigar down, put his hat on, to put his beer away, and goes over and he does the interview just as Wayne always does it, to perfection. And they go, Kid, can we interview you next? He goes, yeah, hang on a second. He lit a cigarette, turned his hat around backwards, got a beer and went up, or a whiskey, and goes, okay, I'm ready.
Yeah. And took off his golf shirt. So his muscle shirt was on.
Oh, no, he didn't wear a golf shirt. He wore that muscle shirt.
He wore the muscle shirt and the John Deere hat. And, he's such a lovable guy. And there was a helicopter hovering over the tournament all day. I don't know whether it was set up by you guys, but it was media. And they kind of come down low. And Kid, I was standing beside him, and he looked up, and he just flipped the bird to the helicopter.
Oh, it was great.
It was great. Remember, he lit up a cigarette inside the Empress Hotel? He was just – anyway, wonderful story. And to your buddy, well, those are beautiful thoughts. And okay, Rusty, before we go, I guess we better talk a little bit of hockey. So the season, Rusty, is this compacted season of they're going to try and do 56 games. COVID is not letting off, and a bunch of games have been postponed. I don't know how they're going to do it now. Some teams have had to miss 5 and 6 games there. They thought, Rusty, this might be pretty cool when it started, that it would generate these big rivalries in Canada. And I watch Sports Desk probably like you do, you know, to catch the scores and stuff and see what's going on. And it's not working, Russ. I don't think those rivalries, it's not. It's just not working, okay? There's no...
Debbie Downer. Oh,
and I think, Russ, the hockey isn't that good. And I wanted to ask you about this because I think they're too tired. I think they've got 3 games. Like Toronto, Ottawa has a 3-game, 4-night deal going on. Russ, what's it... like, does one hockey game and kick the shit out of a guy, and that playing back-to-back games or playing 3 games in 4 nights, is that really hard on the body, Russ, for an NHLer?
Before I answer, have you been out of your house in weeks, days? And have you seen the sunshine? Oh, my God.
Why? What did I do? Oh,
God, that is so depressing. I think it is tough to play that many games in a row on the guys. Right. It is. And maybe that's taken taking away.
It's made it boring hockey, I think. I don't know if that's a bad take or not. But
yeah, I mean, I've been enjoying the games that I've watched. I've been watching more about my son more than I've been watching the NHL. But what I've seen, I mean, the announcers sound great, and the noise on the TV, that sound and the visual, to me, looks good. But Lawton played 3 games, and he played 4 games in 5 nights. And the fourth game yesterday was 3 and 3 nights.
Right.
It was brutal. Like the guys, they came out and then crash and burn. They just couldn't do it.
Right.
And then the game just got out of hand. They got spanked. And I just, I wonder if that's taking away from the hockey that you're talking about, that players are resting themselves so they can last. Because Jeff Jackson, who's McDavid's agent, and Matthews and many others, he thought there was going to be a lot of injuries. And because
of
wear and tear and just tired and guys getting hurt. So it's not easy to go, you know, night after night after night. It's tough. It's hard. It's a hard game. And so there isn't the normal recovery. And maybe guys are pacing themselves because it's so grueling right now. I don't know.
Well, I would think some coaching must come into that, Russ, where the guy's going, look at you boys. Okay, let's not scrum it up. Okay, we got such a long, intense season here. Do you think maybe?
I would say that all the coaches and players are in the same boat, that this is the first time they've ever done it. So they're learning as they go. Nobody's got the book on, you know, we did this 5 years ago and this is how we managed. No one's been through it. So they're all going through it together and learning on the fly. I think this is where you need that, you know, that depth chart where you got some really good players that you can insert into the lineup or play.
Well, it's kind of like a 7-game series, playoff series. Right?
Well, yeah. I find when I turn the TV, I'm like, is this a replay of the you know, because in the afternoon you can turn on one of the NHL channels and they'll have a game on from the night before.
Right.
And I have to take a second look once in a while and go, shit, are they replaying this game or are they playing again?
Right.
They're playing again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's too much. It's too much.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you say that. Rick Tocchet and Philly was playing Gretzky. Was it Philly? Rick Tocchet was with her
playing. He used to play for Philly.
Yeah, no, I know that. Anyway, he's playing against Gretz and it's a playoff series.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is great.
And he's washing his face, right?
Every shift he's after Gretz.
Right. And Gretz tells the story. I read it this morning where the puck is locked up against the boards and there's 6 or 7 guys trying to tie it up. And he said, it's a really hard thing to do to try and tie up the puck. And you got to wait a long time before the ref blow the whistle. In the meantime, he's in there. Gretz is in there trying to tie the puck up and Tocchet is cross checking him from behind, reaches around with his glove, face washes him. And Gretz goes, I said, hey, would you calm down? You know, would you settle down? And Tocchet said, not at all, pal. Okay. Get used to it. Every shift, every freaking game. Okay. For the next 7 games. And Gretz said, 7? I'll be done in 4, pal.
Yeah. I don't know what series you're going to be playing in or something.
Yeah, but
like
I'm done in 4.
We'll be done in 4, but pal. Right. And I think they did. Yeah, I don't know if they did, but what a great line.
Oh. And what a great, that's where the rivalry started, you know, or that's how they come
about. And those guys are tight. Wayne and Rick are so close.
So close. Sure. Well, they were together in Phoenix.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. They coached together. And
well, we had Rick on. Go back and check the show. Talk was on. It was one of our most favorable shows by the fans. Okay, Rusty, before you go, one question here from one of the fans. By the way, my nickname Jungle was when I was born. There used to be a comic strip. This is true. My dad was ultra funny. I wish you would have been able to meet him, Russ, because you'll see where all of my shit I stole from my dad. Yeah. And there was a comic strip, a cartoon called Jungle Jim, and it was a goofy-looking guy. And when I was born, my dad, back in those days, you had to wait a day or two to see your own child as the husband. Yeah. And my dad walked in. My mom was holding me, apparently. My dad looked and goes, well, he looks like that idiot in the cartoon, Jungle Jim. And the nurse was there and their family doctor. Anyway, that's how I got it. That's how I got
the my God. Jim. That's great.
Yeah. So I'm a stupid cartoon character. Your dream foursome, Russ. And we'll end the show on this. If you could play golf, we'll say your dream threesome because you're going to get to play with them. So
yeah,
we'll give you 3 or 4 guys because you can play 5 at your course. And I've had that question a number of times from people who are listening to the show. And I said, I will ask them. this week. Who he would, if you got a chance to play golf with three or four guys, who would you pick? Doesn't have to be sports either, Russ, or hockey.
Yeah.
And you're giving us an answer. You're not blowing me off in this. Last time you did, I like that dumb. I don't want to answer that question. You're answering the question.
Wayne Gretzky. Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And
that's pretty good there.
Winston Churchill.
Wow. Why Winston Churchill?
I watched the movie they made, and I'm just curious. Being my families are from England. They came from England and immigrated to Canada, and I'm just fascinated with him and his sayings and I don't know. It just, he has all these one-liners. If you get a chance, go online and Google like Winston Churchill's one-liners.
Well, Russ, sorry to interrupt, but we talk about hockey every once in a while. You know, you talk about the digs, and we just told you about one with Wayne, right? It's going to be four games. Or Austin Matthews gotten all kinds of shit yesterday because he did the usual "What's your name?" and all that. Winston Churchill, the best chirps of all time.
Okay.
This guy could chirp. Yeah.
And one of everyone knows how much I love my red wine. And so he said, his line, he says, a magnum of wine is perfect for one person.
He did, well, pal, he did, God, he said a lady gave him shit because he was a big drinker. A lady gave him shit. Like he might have been in session. He might have been in Parliament. And she said, Mr. Churchill, you're drunk. And he said, you're right, madam. And in the morning, I will be sober and you'll still be ugly. Got to end her on that, Rusty. Great show again, pal. We're back each and every week, of course, with the Suspendables. Go to our website, thesuspendables.com, and all the shows are up there. And thanks a lot. The twalking lives on, Russ. I got to learn how to send you my twalking videos where we talk about the show and have a little bit of fun promoting the show. So we invite
you. Put it on Instagram. Copy me.
We're trying to figure it out. Instagram's tough to put videos up that are longer than a minute, and I can't go shorter. So like and share with your friends, and please tell them all about it, and we'll be back each and every week with another episode of White Claws. No. Rusty, you take it easy, buddy. We'll be back next week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been The Suspendables.
The Suspendables is a weekly podcast series featuring former NHLer Russ Courtnell and host Jim Jerome. Join us for new episodes available each Wednesday morning. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to subscribe and review or share the show with your friends and followers. Check out our website today, thesuspendables.com.